This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Hundreds of thousands of women in pink hats flooded into Washington, D.C. in January of 2017 for the largest single-day protest in American history. And the Women's March stretched beyond the nation's capital. There were sister marches in all 50 states and in more than 30 other countries. This historic demonstration had some pundits claiming that the election of Donald Trump had awakened women-identifying electorate. But Lisa Levenstein argues in her new book that the Women's March and other contemporary activism is rooted in groundwork laid by feminists in the 1990s, whose work has largely been overlooked by popular culture. Lisa joins me now to talk about the book, They Didn't See Us Coming, The Hidden Story of Feminism in the 90s. She is also director of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program at UNC Greensboro. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's great to be here.
What are some of the connections between the Women's March in 2017 and feminist work of the 90s?
Mass movements and protests, you know, they don't emerge out of thin air. They build on activism that happened in the past. So it was really interesting for me to see many people looking at the Women's March and saying, well, this is a response to, you know, the sexism of Donald Trump. If you looked closely at the signs carried by the marchers demanding all kinds of things, the choice of the people, very diverse lineup who were speaking on the stage, and the incredibly broad range of topics that they spoke about, none of that just came out of the blue. It built on decades of feminist organizing, which is, you know, feminists sharing ideas with each other and with the public, them fostering conversations amongst people and creating networks of people. I mean, the same can be said, actually, about the Me Too campaign. The fact that so many women decided they had enough and that it was time to speak out, these women were moved to act in part because the messages that had been spread by feminists. So I really think we need to understand this history to make sense of what's happening today. Because even though organizing might not make headlines at the time, the work that happens can really make a difference.
And that feminist history is a long one, as you suggest. And the broad agenda, the fact that so many issues found themselves under the banner of feminism at that march, perhaps owes to a change that we saw take place in a large way in the 1990s. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that people kind of missed a lot of what was happening in the 1990s and beyond is because they were wedded to a stereotype of feminism that had emerged in the 60s and 1970s with things like the, you know, women's liberation movement, amazing, really, protest against the Miss America pageant, which created an image of feminists as largely a white movement. Now, even at the time, there were women of color, working class women, all kinds of women who were organizing in feminist activism in the 1960s. But the stereotype was really one of a white movement. And what we saw, I think, in the 90s that then really came to fruition at the Women's March and the Me Too campaign and all the kinds of activism in various kinds of movements that is happening today is a shift within the movement insofar as women of color, and even in the 90s, women from the global south, their ideas and their activism were becoming much more central to the movement overall.
Well, talk more about that change, because you said there was a perception or a stereotype that this was a white women's movement, but that it was more broad-based. And yet there were critiques even at the time from communities of color that this movement doesn't include us. So it wasn't just a public perception. Within the movement itself, there were a lot of complaints during that time period, talking about the 60s and 70s. What was happening there?
Yeah, I mean, this has been really a persistent trend in feminist activism, kind of a struggle among activists about who speaks for the movement, who gets to define the movement's goals, what should those goals be, right? And who are the people who are kind of taken as the spokespeople for the movement, often by the media or, you know, the people who are invited up on stage to be the ones who are talking in a very, you know, in very important protests. And what happened in the 90s was that a lot of the national organizations were still, and really today still, you know, we're run by white middle-class women. They were the ones the media looked to if they needed, you know, a feminist comment on the issue, on an issue of the day. And they were often seen to represent the movement at large. But even those national organizations by the 90s, the activism of women of color and women from the global south had gotten so strong and so influential that even they began to realize that they couldn't pretend to speak for all women if they didn't have networks of and connections to and platforms that represented the voices of a much broader group. Something that then and really now, in fact, as well, remains very controversial is who are the actual leaders of this movement? Who are the leaders of national organizations? Who are the people who, you know, kind of face who the media will see and who, you know, the movement itself is choosing to put forward? That remains a very important issue that is debated. But in terms of the kind of rank and file, this is a very diverse movement with lots of debates and struggles going on within it, which I really see as a huge strength.
And as you point out in your book, a pivotal moment in that sort of awakening of consciousness within the movement about how conscious should we be, and we must be more conscious about who is speaking for the movement and how diverse our voice is if, in fact, we are representing this broad base. Maybe that pivotal moment was the International Conference in Beijing in 1995.
This was such a fascinating part of my research. Like, you know, I lived in 1995 when the UN Fourth World Conference on Women took place, and all I knew about it was that then First Lady Hillary Clinton had traveled to China and given a very important speech claiming that women's rights are human rights. Well, when I dug into the archives and the research, what I found was, in fact, there was such a fascinating story going on that most of the media didn't pick up, which was that there was an NGO forum with this that was associated with this conference that drew over 35,000 activists from around the world. It was basically this huge feminist consciousness-raising effort where people had panels and plenaries and celebrations, and they shared strategies and they networked with one another. And over 8,000 activists from the United States, including many grassroots activists, women of color, working class women, traveled to this conference. And what I can, I mean, the best word to describe their experiences was really that they were very humbled. They saw there a global feminist movement with people who had been thinking in global terms for a really long time about issues to do with feminism and global capitalism. They learned a lot from the diverse movement that they encountered. And then they came home and they shared that knowledge with their groups and their communities. And it really was a pivotal moment.
You talk in your book also about other changes in the 90s. Activism in general is changing. It's becoming more professional. In some ways, women can get paid for it. And then the work itself is spreading. Feminism is finding itself as part of other movements, as central to other movements. Talk about those changes.
And it really took me a while to get my head around the fact that in the 1990s, one of the reasons that people missed a lot of what was going on in feminism was that a lot of that activism was being done for pay. So I talk about the professionalization of activism to kind of describe this process. What I mean is that activism for many people in the 90s wasn't something you did in your spare time after work. It was your job, right? So you had a job maybe in a domestic violence shelter or a rape crisis center and various kinds of feminist nonprofits that were springing up throughout the country. Or people were feminist doctors, right? Feminist lawyers, or like me, feminist academics. So we often don't think about paid work as a form of activism, but it was really crucial in spreading feminist ideas and creating activist networks. And as you pointed out, another transformation that was happening at this time that made feminism a little bit kind of invisible was that some of the most important and really innovative kinds of activism was taking place within other social movements. So, for example, both the labor movement and the environmental justice movement had really strong feminist leaders. They were committed to gender equity and to organizing on behalf of those most oppressed. So these organizers weren't organizing under the banner of feminism, but they saw their interests as really interconnected. And really, this has really continued. So many of the most influential leaders today in Black Lives Matter and the Fight for 15, they're feminists. They're promoting feminist principles. So it's really another example of how the roots that took shape in the 90s have a legacy that we can continue to see right now.
And the failure to see all of those movements and those changes and that evolution as feminism, the growth of feminism, may have been what led Time magazine to ask if feminism was dead in 1998. Clearly, they were wrong. And maybe another way to illustrate the way that it's changing and working its way into other or finding its expression in other movements is an activist profile, one that you tell in your book, a story you tell. Tell us about Pamela Chang.
Pamela Chang, some woman that I interviewed for my book, she was an Asian American student at UC Berkeley in the early 90s. She was studying pre-med, and she came to Berkeley thinking she had an interest in environmental activism. So she saw an ad for, meeting of the Greenpeace chapter on campus. And she attended that meeting, but she said she was really disappointed. She was the only person who looked like her at the meeting, first of all. And the primarily white students there, they saw environmental activism as about, as she put it, saving the redwoods. And that really wasn't what she had in mind. She didn't see that kind of environmental activism helping the people who lived in the poor immigrant community that she grew up in. It was a community where people were struggling with things like environmental hazards in their workplaces, right? That's how they kind of interpreted the environment and the kind of activism that was needed around this issue. So what happened was that she got together with a few other students of color on campus, and they discovered the work of the Southwest Organizing Project, which was a multiracial environmental justice organization that was doing work around toxic waste dumping in impoverished communities of color, and also about the conditions that factory workers were facing with fumes and other kinds of health hazards. What's really fascinating to me is that when Chang discovered this environmental justice movement and she got involved in it and started to go to meetings off campus and be invited actually to really high-level meetings, she rose and became one of the leaders of this movement. When she first got involved as a student, she discovered this incredible movement of people of color, but she also discovered a form of feminism, because it turned out that many of the leaders in this movement were low-income women of color, and that the founding documents of the movement included from the very start an emphasis on gender equality. So the working class women in this movement, a lot of them didn't necessarily identify as, they didn't call themselves feminist. They also thought of feminism as something that was about white women. But over time, many of them did become involved in some of the new multiracial feminist organizing that was happening.
What's fascinating about all of this and the story that you tell in your book is the subtext, which is that feminism, unlike some other movements that fall apart, that fracture when these fault lines build in, feminism always or often seems to expand to embrace these rather than fall apart. And it has done that from the start.
I think that's such an interesting and important point, Frank. I always kind of have a problem with the word fracture, because it suggests that something was once all together and then it fell apart. If I know anything from studying the history of feminism over decades, even centuries, it's that there's never been one version of this movement. There's never been one single idea in fact, what feminism is, who feminists are, what it should represent, what the priorities should be. This has been the subject of fierce contestation for centuries, for decades. But what has really happened, as you're pointing out, is that these debates, these generative conversations are happening in more and more places. And the the reach of feminism is expanding to include more and more people, more and more sites, more and more forms of organizing. And that's what I find really exciting.
And it points to another myth that you uncovered, which is that about generational tension within feminism. Tell us what your analysis is.
That's another really interesting myth, the idea that each generation kind of reinvents feminism and, you know, rebels against the generations of the past. That's not what I found in my research necessarily. I found that there were certainly fractures in feminism with people, some people, you know, more radical than others, you know, a kind of, you know, moderates versus radicals. This is something we see in all social movements. But the idea that these splits were always generational, I think really misses the mark. The splits were there and the debates and tensions were there, but they were about politics. They were about different visions of the past. And I mean, I think if you've been involved in activist circles at all, you probably know that often some of the most radical people are people who've been in the trenches for decades, right? It doesn't always fall out along these generational lines that the media sometimes likes to, you know, the media presents it often as like mothers versus daughters. I mean, in these very gendered terms, it's much more complicated, much more complicated than that. And feminists, like all other movements, often split around their visions of what kind of society they want to live in and what they think they should do to get there.
Lisa Levenstein, the author of They Didn't See Us Coming, The Hidden History of Feminism in the 90s, also director of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program at UNC Greensboro. Lisa, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more about her book and everything we talk about at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.